Hello folks, welcome back, and if you're a new listener, welcome to the show. You're listening to the High Performance Human Podcast, and I'm your host, Simon Ward. Now, you might not realize this, but you are a high performance human. This concept of high performance can be described as a measurable state where an individual, which is you, consistently performs at a higher level of operational success compared with most of their peers within the same environment at a particular time. So if you're an endurance athlete and you train or compete regularly, please don't just compare yourself to those other athletes. Instead, think about all the other folks of your age, friends, people you work with. Compared to them, you are operating at a very high level. Now, I appreciate you might still want to improve on that, and if so, then we'd love to help you. It might be sleep, nutrition, physical activity, personal relationships, work habits, and so much more. I've currently got availability to take on a couple of clients, and my wife Beth, who's a certified life coach, also has availability. So depending on what you're looking to focus on, we've got you covered, and you can find contact details in the show notes below. Okay, on to this week's show. As we continue our journey, your journey as an endurance athlete, you might occasionally think that life is messing you about. Always seem to be obstacles to be navigated, work and family challenges, illness, injury, world events beyond your control. And it might even cross your mind from time to time that these only seem to happen to you and that other folks have smooth paths to their chosen event. Rest assured, everyone has challenges. And that includes today's podcast guest, Flight Sergeant Scott Hill from the RAF Regiment. Now, as you'll hear in the podcast, Scott wears many hats in his life. He's a father, a husband, and a career serviceman. In the last 18 months, he's effectively been doing two jobs at work while battling a long-term back injury. On top of that, qualified as a British triathlon high performing coach to enhance the work he does in his private triathlon coaching business and as head coach of the RAF tri team. Not only that, he's also an excellent age group triathlete, having qualified for the Ironman World Championships in Hawaii twice. He's also an ambassador for my favorite tri clothing brand, Racekin. So as with so many of our guests, I'm just tired reading that out. So let's crack on and find out just how Scott Hill manages to wear so many hats. Welcome, Scott Hill. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
No, it's great to be here, Simon, and it's good to speak to you again after a few months.
It is. We do bump into each other on a regular basis, don't we? In various different guises. I'm sure we'll touch on all of those today. You're a man of many parts.
Yeah, I think the first time we bumped into each other was in an airport, and then it's been at various events and things across the years.
It was. You were just telling me that about your trips to Kona, which we'll cover, and I think that's where we met, and you were on your way out to Hawaii, as I was, and that was 2015, so long time since, almost, well, 8.5 years.
Yeah, but it seems like yesterday. The memories are still fresh from all of that, but exciting times.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll get to all of that eventually, and all of these different hats you wear at different times of the day, probably not just the different times of the month. But let's go right back to the beginning. So you're in the military. I think your dad was in the military, was he, as well?
Yeah. So I'm in the Royal Air Force, been in the Royal Air Force now this will be the 22nd year for myself, but I come from a long line of military, being fifth generation, I believe, off the top of my head. So yeah, it's a longstanding thing with our family.
So was sport a big thing for you growing up?
So most of my childhood, I grew up in Scotland, in the Highlands. And if you didn't know, there's a game up there they play called Shinty, mm-hmm. Which is quite rough. Obviously, the Irish version is hurling, and you might have seen that in some of the adverts for the Irish drink. But yeah, I grew up playing a team sport, Shinty, in the early years through primary school into early high school before I left there and moved back down to England. So that was my real sport at the time. And then other than that, it was just me and my mountain bike that just got around between the little villages, speaking and seeing all my friends and whatever else we did. Because going back to them days, kids just were out doing whatever they did and came home for their dinner when it got dark.
If you came home too early, your mum would want to know why you were in trouble and what you'd done wrong, right?
Yeah, that was it. It was just, the nighttime was the thing. You went out, disappeared, did whatever you did, and then you came back and it was dinner time and then reset for the next day, really. It was a really good time. I love growing up in the Highlands, and I think it's something that a lot of children don't get to do today.
No, absolutely. I spent most of my formative childhood in Yorkshire, and I used to do the same as you, in the holidays, get on my bike first thing in the morning after I'd had my breakfast and see you, Mum, and off I went. Sometimes I'd go back for a sandwich at lunchtime if I was hungry, and that's when she'd ask me what was wrong. And then come back when it was getting dark, usually late, so I was in trouble because my tea had gone cold. And you did everything, didn't you? You'd get around. We used to go fishing down at this little stream and make fishing rods. There was a castle in our village, a derelict castle, so we used to go climbing on the walls there and doing all sorts of things, football games. Yeah. But I think you're right. Kids these days don't seem to be able to roam quite as far from home, do they?
No, I don't think they're doing it. It's a shame in a lot of ways. And I think that's just where myself, you know, as the athlete now, that what I do is just, it's come from them days of cycling a bike very young. You know, that's my favourite discipline. It's what I get most pleasure out of. And I think it just reverts back to my childhood.
You're in the RAF, and I know you're in the RAF regiment, which for most people looking in when they see you in uniforms would look more like your soldiers from the army. But when I talk to people who are in preparation of soldiers, PTIs and that sort of thing, they always talk about how, particularly those folks who are career soldiers like you, talk about how the young ones coming in today just don't have the physical conditioning at 18 that kids of 20 years used to, and that you actually have to spend a whole load of time getting them up to speed before you can get them fit for purpose.
Yeah, there's been a generational shift. Some things have had to change. Some things, you know, over the generations, we don't like to see change. And that goes back even before my time. You know, those people of old would look at me and think it wasn't like that in my day. It was a lot harder than what it was you have to do. And I suppose that's the same with my generation today. You know, I'm coming up to my 22nd years. Yes, some things have changed for the better. Some things I would say have changed for the worse. But ultimately, the force as a whole has to change. It has to change with times. We have to accept change, and you know, we've got to lead by example as well at the same time.
Yeah, I guess I've got some friends who have been in the police, and they're saying, you know, just recruits these days, they come in not well conditioned, whereas everybody had a basic level of fitness then, because we used to run around all the time, and we perhaps didn't spend all day sitting down playing video games, because, well, certainly when I was growing up, there were none.
No, but some of the equipment that we use today, it uses the technology that you would use. Yeah. So the computer controllers and stuff like that. So that generation of person is vital in today's military for a lot of things.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. So you've been in 22 years. How old are you now then?
I'm coming up to 41 this summer.
41. Okay, so you joined when you were just exiting your teen years. You were into cycling. Were you immediately into I know that the Army and the Marines offer good opportunities for people who are keen sportsmen. Is that the same in the RAF?
It is, but it's different. We are still expected to do our job on a day-to-day basis. We do have different levels of people doing different levels of sport, you know, all the way from just they do it for pleasure, they do it for leisure, all the way up to elite athletes in whatever field they're in. You know, the RAF's got elite football players, elite rugby players. We've got elite triathletes now as well. So depending on what level they're at, depending on what flex in the system they get, some will get extra leave to go, you know, train and participate in sport, but the majority still are required to do their day-to-day job and fit everything else in around that.
So there won't be any of this. You're a full-time athlete and you're allowed to be a full-time athlete and sort of take almost like leave of absence from your role as a military person. I think the last person I spoke to that was in the military that was doing that was probably Kat Matthews, who was in the Army, but had been allowed time off to pursue her triathlon career. I remember Bernie Shrewsbury was in the Marines and he was effectively a full-time cross-country skier and triathlete.
Yeah, so we do have some, and they'll go and do that full time. Rugby players has probably been the biggest area for the Air Force, okay. But we do have other sports doing it, and they might go and do it full time for a set period. But you know, they'll still have to give back as well.
Okay. So, going into the RAF, then, did you get involved in triathlon then, or were you doing that before you joined, or was that something that you were attracted to at a later time?
Later time. So I'd always kept fit. You know, when I've gone away on deployments, then it was always the gym was my thing when I'm away, a little bit of running here and there, but predominantly just gym work, and that's just kind of what we all did. And then in 2012, I decided to participate in a triathlon that we did Land's End to John O'Groats, On the way, we climbed the three peaks and we swam across Lake Balla, Lake Windermere and Loch Ness over a period of 2 weeks. And that was the start of it for me, really, because a few of those athletes there had done various types of triathlon and it was just the old military banter. And I thought, I fancy a bit of this. Let's have a go.
2012. I'm just trying to think then. That was Olympic year, of course. So London, were you already aware of triathlon then, or was it the sort of, you know, the hype around 2012 and the Brownlees winning that finally sealed it for you? Is that something I'm going to try?
No, so even at that point, I didn't really know anything about it. It was purely that event, which was put on by other military personnel that organised it. And I was just, I was a tag along, really. I was just one of the few that got to do it and just fell in love with it from that point onwards, really.
I've always been struck when I look at your physique, you're quite muscular as far as triathletes go, carrying a bit of muscle there, which probably harks back to those gym days. Were you a big chap then? Were you carrying a few more pounds?
Yeah, muscle mass, yes. I would have been, you know, bouncing around probably 98 kilograms.
Right, and what's your racing weight now?
So now I'm probably around about 78 kilograms.
That's a significant loss of muscle. Was that, did you lose that deliberately, or did it just naturally fall off when you stopped going to the gym as much and doing a bit more swim, bike and run?
Yeah, absolutely all natural. I don't chase weight at all. I think it's quite a dangerous area. So it's something I'm not a fan of, you know, as an athlete and a coach. My body shape's what it is. Yes, it'll be different from them days of doing all that gym work. Mm. But where I'm at now is it's just naturally got to this point. I don't chase to be lighter, to perform better, or chase that, you know, that terminology, race weight. I do what I do. I enjoy what I do, and if performance comes with it, then I take that as well.
Yeah, I'm not keen on the whole race weight thing, because I feel like folks, I know there's a book out there, and I get people saying, well, what should my race weight be? And I'm like, it's just wherever you feel best and where you race best. But, you know, train for a triathlon and eat well, and your body will look after itself. If you end up, and you know, if you're going the other way and lifting weights, you're probably not going to put on any muscle because there's just too much endurance work in there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, many of my friends and colleagues now, the triathletes, if I stand next to them, I'm substantially bigger than they are just for my natural frame. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to be a professional triathlete. You know, this is about participating in the sport, enjoying the sport, still getting, you know, good results if I can do it. But, you know, if that comes with everything that I'm doing naturally, then I'm more than happy for that.
Okay. So so what was your first triathlon there? Was it in 2012 or was it next year?
2014, Ironman UK, Bolton.
No, you started at the top then. You didn't go, I'll have a sprint first, see how that goes, then up to a standard. You went, right, let's choose the hardest one in the UK and we'll just do that one.
Yeah, so it's even worse than that, to be honest. I decided to do Bolton and Wales in the same year. And that's probably the advice that every coach would give every triathlete not to do, you know, go and enjoy it and do what you do. But, you know, I come from a long-standing military career, really, at that year. I'd done arduous courses. I knew I was, you know, mentally and physically pretty robust. And, you know, some friends of mine had done them and I was probably fitter than they were. So I thought, you know what, I can do this.
I think, I mean, you're a coach and we'll talk about that later. You're a coach at a high level. And you've got a lot of experience, and you've probably had people who ask you, yeah, I'm thinking about doing triathlon. I'd like to do Ironman and see that Lanzarote's a good one to do. It's like just about the hardest one you can select in Europe, bar those other two you mentioned. But some of those people are starting from ground zero. Whereas, you know, if you've cycled Lanzarote to John O'Groats over 2 weeks, you've been able to run up and down the three biggest mountains in the mainland, and you've been able to swim across some cold, dark, and, you know, lakes that have got a reasonable distance. You obviously had all the pieces in place. So whilst you didn't have the triathlon experience, you definitely had the background to be able to cope with that, I think.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I've done arduous courses in the military. Some of these friends that had done Ironmans and various other sporting events, you know, I'd done training with them, and I knew that, you know, I was on par, if not better than some of them at what we were doing. I just hadn't put them all together and ever done a triathlon. So yeah, I just jumped in with both feet and thought, let's do two within the space of 7 weeks.
Mm. So tell us about the first one then, because Bolton was, actually, you know, I think I did Ironman Wales in 2014, so it was around then. So Tell us about how it worked out at Bolton Egg, because that's a pretty tough course for your first one, isn't it? It's a good northern course. There's lots of climbing, but they're short and sharp. And I know a lot of people that come from further south are shocked.
Yeah, so it was the swim. You know, the swim's what it was. I'm not the best swimmer out there, but I'm okay. You know, and I just thought, well, I can get myself through this. I've done this in training, in lakes and in the swimming pool and stuff, so I knew I could achieve that. And the bike was where I spent a lot of time training. You know, I was doing a lot of 100-mile rides in the build-up for that. At the time, I was living around Salisbury. So I was part of the Salisbury Triathlon Club at the time. I was training with athletes from there. So that's probably where it really started with the triathlon community. And, you know, I was doing okay in the training. But it was on the race day when it came to the bike. I got to that point. I was relatively comfortable. I even remember coming past one of the pro males at the time. I couldn't even tell you who he was, but I remember just stopping and having a conversation with him and how nice his bike was. And then I just said, see you later, mate, and carried on. Off I went cycling again. And then it was when I got onto the run was when I really thought, yeah, this is tough. This is a difficult day out. And I still did relatively well. I think at the time I finished that race in under 10 hours 30. Yeah, it was a good day. It was a learning experience. The run for me was the eye opener, and that was what this was all about. And then I realized at that point, I've got another one in less than 2 months. What am I doing, basically?
So what did you do? Because that isn't a lot of time to, and I think, and you, again, you'll recognize this now with more experience and also as a coach. To get through an event like Bolton requires a lot of mental resilience, not just for the event, but for the training. And if you push yourself mentally, that takes a bit of recovering from. So, and I know a lot of people are super excited when they come across the line, and you'll have known this, you know, come across, say never again to the catchers at the finish line, but then the next morning you're looking at all your times and thinking, actually, if I enter this one, I could beat that. So, you know, that never again is pretty soon forgotten. But I know a lot of people like, oh, it's a one and done. I'm done. I couldn't do that again. So how did you get yourself back up? And also, what sort of training did you do to get ready for Wales?
No, I think initially I just took 2 weeks of doing nothing after that race, just to recover, because I was pretty fatigued. Body was a bit battered. And fortunately, one of my friends, he was doing Ironman Wales as well. He was in the army. He's a doctor, but he still works within the military system as a doctor down in Norfolk. And I went along to that one with him. And I remember we stayed in the youth hostel near Tenby, and all the safety staff for Ironman Wales were staying in the youth hostel as well. And they were the kayakers, the canoers for the sea, and they went out and had a few drinks the night before the race. And we didn't get much sleep because they came in, they were all a bit rowdy. And then obviously we started that race pretty tired from not getting much sleep the night before. But you probably remember the sea on that occasion was pretty rough. And there's an iconic picture out there with all the athletes stood on the beach in the green swim caps, and the waves were just throwing themselves in, and it was quite daunting because that was my first ever time being in the sea like that. And obviously I knew I had to swim 2.4 miles.
I can remember that. My first impression was, because I'd been down the day before for a swim. I met Mark Leanthus, who's just been on the podcast, and we went for a swim. And when we came up, it looked like all this polythene had been washed up on the beach. And when he got close, it was those huge, great big jellyfish that had been washed up. I remember thinking, well, I never saw any of those. And then it was a nice, calm morning. I think Duncan Shea Simmons and his wife were there as well. And so we all had a chat together and looking at where we should swim. And the next morning you get there, you get the parade through town, and you walk down, you get your shoes set up, the crowd's arriving, and the tide's about half a mile away, and it's only about 45 minutes till the start. And it comes in really quickly, doesn't it? So, you know, by the time you get out of your first lap, you've hardly got anywhere to run on the beach from when you started. But I do remember swimming along and seeing this person in front of me in a wetsuit with yellow arms, and they were on my right-hand side. And then as the next wave came in, they were still ahead of me, but they were about 5 meters to my left, and then on the next stroke I looked up and they were back here on my right, and it was like just being in a massive washing machine.
Yeah, that's the biggest things I remember from that is probably the waves, the swim caps. There's a picture that is there that it's got the front row of all the swimmers when they first went in, and I'm actually in the front row because I just threw myself in at the deep end, literally there. And then the other thing for me is just all the pink bags with everyone's trainers in or flip flops
on the zigzags. Yeah,
that's the biggest things for me from that swim start. And then obviously the national anthem for Wales as well. That was just electric.
I mean, you can see why it's such a popular event, can't you? And the other thing that stood out for me was we had a tailwind. That was why the water was so rough, because they'd moved the swim to that bay, hadn't they, from the previous year, because it was too rough for the prevailing winds from the west. And then the wind changed, so you got all this easterly wind. But it was a tailwind going out to the very far corner to angle.
Yeah.
But then, of course, you flew out there, but then, of course, once you turned around and started riding back towards Tenby, you were into a headwind.
Yeah, that's right. And then, I mean, again, there's a military train area out that way, so I kind of knew where that was. You know, we've been out there before doing exercises and stuff. But yeah, it can get pretty windy down there.
And then just the people in the town. You know, when you're running through the cobbles outside all the pubs, 5 deep all afternoon, just people getting more noisy and more drunk as you went around.
So one of the biggest things I tell every person that's going to go for it is, that stands out for me, is on the bike course, there's always a family that they're on the edge of a farm in a field, and they use the tractors and the tractor bucket with a sofa in it, and they've got a barbecue.
Yes.
And that was just a picture that stood out in my mind as well. And I tell everyone about that as well.
There's my very first triathlon I did in Ironman Canada, which was 1995. It was an out and back run, and you run down along by the side of the lake. And so you've got the lake on your right hand side as you're going out. And then there's a whole load of houses, not many, because it's quite sparsely populated between the two towns. But there's this house just set back about 100 meters from the lake, but just on the hillside. And the garden comes down and it overlooks the road. And it was about 5-6 meters above the road. And I remember that they had two armchairs that they must have dragged down all the way from the house. And they got all these flags out, and there was 10 of them sitting on these armchairs. They'd got cooler boxes. They got a water spray. And I did that race 4 or 5 times, and the same thing. Every year you went past and there was these people sat on this sort of red velour armchair, sofa. It was a...
For me?
Yeah.
I say for me, it's things like that stand out. That's what, you know, adds that little bit of extra to the racing experience. It's just things like that you notice. And if they do it year on year and everyone gets to experience it, you know, they're fully invested in it as well, even though they're not doing the sport. And I love that.
Yeah, like the superhero characters on Cheap House Lane.
Yeah, exactly.
Ironman UK. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's those, when you talk to people from around the world who've done races, you know, if you talk to Americans that have come over to do Ironman UK or Ironman Wales, they'll talk about exactly those same things. You know, the Heartbreak Hill coming up out of Tenby, you know, that first time round, you see people pushing a big gear, racing up there because the crowd, it sounds like a football crowd, and everybody gets this extra burst of energy. But then when you've gone past the crowd, everybody's sort of sitting up to breathe. Because they've exhausted themselves.
And that just reminds you of something you see on TV when you watch the Tour de France. You feel like you're in the moment. And it's just, I'm not going to be able to get through these people.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, I can think of examples like that from every single Ironman I've done. You know, just specific things about getting to the top of a hill, or some Austrian house music playing by the lake or something. Okay. So, you do Ironman UK. Wait, did you qualify for Kona in Wales that year then, or did that wait until the next year?
Yeah, so that was, I qualified, I got the first roll down slot from Wales for that year, and being relatively new to the sport, not really knowing what was going on, what I was doing. It was just an opportunity. And that's, you know, one of the words that I live by is opportunity. And I thought, this might never happen again. So I just jumped in and went for that, you know, and just took on the challenge of going to Kona in 2015. Being relatively new to the sport, you know, the opportunity just landed on my lap, really. And I thought I had to take that.
I have heard some people say to me, if I got a roll down spot, I wouldn't take it because you've not officially qualified. I mean, for me, that's nonsense, particularly as I did the legacy route and, you know, did 12. But did you ever get any pushback from folks about getting a roll down slot, or did you ever, you said you were early into your triathlon career, so you probably didn't recognize this then, but have you ever thought since, I wish I'd earned that spot outright?
No, not at all. You know, the opportunity's there. I think it was, I'm not that I've heard anything personally, whether people, you know, do believe you shouldn't take roll down slots, then I don't know. But it just, it was there. And I just thought, you know what, this is something that is the pinnacle of the sport. Mm. I have to go. I have to do this. It might never happen again. I might never do another triathlon. You don't know. So, yeah, I took it. And that was me in prep for that one.
I mean, I don't hold any truck with that thought that, you know, it's a roll down slot. It's not as valid as earning a qualification. Ironman put that opportunity in there. And somebody needs to take it. And like you say, you don't know when it will come around again. Who knows what's happening the week later. So it's all very exciting in your first year. What did you do next year to prepare then? Did you take it easy and make the whole year about Kona, or did you have another race in 2015?
I decided to go to Austria and have a go at that one as well.
Okay. So you recognise what I was just saying about the house music.
Yes. Yeah, I do, yeah. Austria was just on the cards. And again, I went out there with a military friend. He's a Royal Air Force PTI. And we actually made a bit of a road trip of it and drove out there and made that a bit of an experience as well. Mm. So that was all part and parcel of that. You know, it was doing something with a friend. It was, I wouldn't necessarily say having a holiday, but we just made a bit of an adventure out of it and drove out and did the Ironman event out there, which again was another experience. The heat was just on another level, and that was learning for me, which was pivotal. But I enjoyed that one. And again, yes, remember the music on the hills out there, long descents. You know, I always talk about swimming in the lake, and as you come into the canal, it's just like I always think it's just, I think of it as like a pond with too many tadpoles in it, and it's just absolute chaos and carnage. And then for there, the heat and the bell on the run as well, that's something that stands out for me.
Oh, the one you...
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, there was a guy in front of me who jumped up on the first, and I remember seeing him jump up and thinking, well, that's not going to end well. And he landed and he took two steps and his hamstring cramped up. And I'm like, there you go. But then as I was coming back, I thought, oh, everybody's ringing the bell, I should do. And I did. And guess what happened?
It was good experience. And that's, you know, that's what we're here for. You know, we're here to experience life ultimately. And that's kind of what I do with the sport now, is to experience life and travel and get the most out of it.
The thing that always stands out for me with Ironman Austria is just the colour of the lake, you know, that sort of turquoisey green. And, you know, when you go into the Lido and you go and it's so clean when you go in there, it's like going into your local swimming pool, but go through the turnstiles, pay your money. There's all the lush grass. It's so tidy. There's no rubbish. You've got those beautiful wooden pontoons stretching out into the lake. You can jump off. Everything's set up. There's an open air swimming pool that's got that wooden surround.
That's right.
And I just love that whole vibe of being there and everybody just being there for the race and looking so fit and healthy, and then jumping in the water and it was like a bath.
In recent years, you see people are fearful of whether it's going to be a wetsuit and non-wetsuit swim. And I even experienced that at that point. You know, it was going to be, you know, 1 minute it was a non-wetsuit swim, then it was a wetsuit swim. It was, fortunately for me, I prefer swimming in a wetsuit, but it was a wetsuit swim at the time. But, you know, people are fearful of that. And at the end of the day, you know, we get in the pool and we swim, you know, 4K, 5K. So if you can do it in a pool or in a lake without a wetsuit in the UK, you can do it on these events as well.
I think that part of that is because folks set themselves up with this expectation of what swim time they're going to do based on wearing a wetsuit, which is obviously faster than what they swim in the pool. But it's unrealistic. I mean, I think Austria, I knew that Austria could be a non-wetsuit swim. That was the first one where I actually took the precaution of buying a swim skin just in case. It wasn't a wetsuit swim. And I was a bit disappointed, really, because swimming is my favourite thing. But I remember them saying the day before, it might be a non-wetsuit swim tomorrow. And, you know, you just saw these 80% of the shoulders in the briefing just dropped and people's hearts sank. And then on race morning, they said it's going to be a wetsuit swim. The water temperature just sneaked under the a bit. And 80% of the field were dancing around and smiling because they'd got the wetsuits. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very, very strange dynamic. But we're all in the same boat, as I like to say.
We are. And of course, if you want to go to Kona, it's a non-wetsuit swim, right? Nobody ever expects to wear a wetsuit there.
Absolutely.
Okay. So tell us about your first experience at Kona. Because that is different again, isn't it? It's on another level.
Yeah. So I actually traveled out there on my own. Rather than staying in you know, the hype of the resorts, I decided to book myself into a local sort of, well, it was actually a coffee farm. So someone mm-hmm. that was making organic coffee up in the mountains. And I hired a hire car and I just stayed up there with them. And obviously would travel down every day and go and practice swim, you know, get out of my bike and, you know, run through the energy lab and stuff like that. So I soaked it up. I went out there for 2 weeks before and I just soaked up the atmosphere and everything going on. But at the same time, I managed to disconnect myself from things and sort of go into a local environment and shop in the shops they were shopping in mm-hmm. and eat with them. And actually, the coffee farm I was staying on every morning, they would make breakfast and you'd sit outside and you'd actually eat with a family, which was really, mm-hmm. really, it was a pretty cool experience. And this was just... they had workers there as well. I think they call them wolfers or something, where they come to the island and they get fed and accommodated, but they have to work for it. So I got to experience that side of life on the island as well. And again, that's it just instills their memories in my mind. And I've got that to take away from that experience as well.
When you say it was a cool experience, it probably was a bit cooler for you actually, because I think people underestimate just how warm and humid it is if you're living down just off a lee drive by the ocean.
Yeah, it's warm. That's the bit that affects me the most. It's the humidity. And that first part of that run course, that's where it just saps my energy. Mm. For me, it's the humidity that really gets to me personally. But when I go away, I try to, you know, shut off from using air conditioning and stuff like that as well. So in most hotel rooms or Airbnbs that people are using, they all have these aircon systems. But just from knowing what I know through my military background as well and being away on deployments to hot climates, I try to just separate myself from the aircon system so that my body can get used to things and adapt as quick as possible.
I remember one of the first trips I made to Kona, I was working for CompuTrainer at the time. And CompuTrainer used to sponsor this chap called John Howard. For those aficionados of Ironman history, they'll know John Howard because he was one of the very early winners. He was also a world record holder on the bike. I think he won an Olympic medal in cycling. He had the fastest ever human-powered bicycle time of, I think he got close to, I'm going to say 100 miles an hour. But anyway, he'd ridden on Bonneville Salt Platz on this huge bike with a huge gearing behind behind a fairing pulled along by a motorbike. He reminded me of the professor out of Gone Back to the Future. Messy hair, and he was just a bit wacky. A really, really smart guy to talk to, but a bit wacky. And he wouldn't let us put the aircon on in the condo. And it was really, really hot and sticky. I couldn't sleep at night. So when he was out, I'd turn it on. And as if he came back, he'd turn it off. And there was this constant battle going on between on and off. But he had that same principle of, look, you want to get used to the humidity for race day. You can't just train in it. You've got to live in it. And that's the best way to adapt. But it's uncomfortable for a few days to start with.
Yeah, absolutely. It does. And, you know, the body's trying to shift to other factors, you know, the time zone difference as well. And you've got that factor in there. Potentially your food choice is different to what you would normally eat as well. So it's trying to balance it all out in the correct way and get the best of it for, you know, acclimatization for race day.
It's really interesting, isn't it? You see this at a lot of races, but probably more so at Kona, because there's this sort of hardcore of people that come in. They're easily identifiable because they look completely different to anybody else. And they're pretty much all in the same spot in Kona. They're all swimming at the same time in the ocean. They're all going for breakfast at Lava Java or Hugo's over the road. And we were in the expo, so you'd see people coming in on the first evening because the parade ended there. But then they'd come back the next day and the next day and the next day, walking around in the heat, you know, being in the sunshine all day, not drinking enough. I'm just burning all the matches before race day. So staying out of it, out of town, probably is the best way to keep some of those energy reserves back.
Yeah, it was a bit cooler in the evenings, you know, and they get a bit of cloud cover and some rain sometimes as well. So, yeah, it was definitely a different side of the island, really, considering you're not that far away.
We stayed up on the mountain at the house of a friend last time, and it was a bit of a drive, but it was definitely a few degrees colder and a bit more rainy, a bit cloudier. So, yeah, probably nicer place to stop.
I got organic coffee every morning as well.
Yeah, well, lots to like about that, eh? If you're a triathlete. Did the RAF have a triathlon team at that point then? Because when you go to Kona and or race in America, one of the things that I'm always taken with is the strong presence of the military athletes representing the services out there. And in fact, they do have a military division, don't they, that you can qualify for. And also they have a prize for the best military athlete, male and female, on the, at the awards ceremony.
Yes, the military divisions, I think it's never been the same as the years have gone on. It's always fluctuated a little bit. And if you were to race and qualify in the military division, you're actually taken out of the age group contention as well. So I know on the Ironman race calendar, you normally have to look and see which races have got the little asterisks next to it. And that would indicate, you know, what that race qualifies you for. And there was a period where there might be a few races on for the military division. And in fact, Bolton was it one year. And then any military across the world could represent their military service in that race, and then they would qualify, and then they could go and race Kona in the military division. But yeah, there's a separate category. So it's kind of a catch-22. It's, you know, do you target that? And there's some very, very fast athletes out there in the military, you know, across the world in different countries. So it's I know some people that did it when it came to the UK, and they qualified and they went out to Kona based on the military division.
Must be something about being called Scott. I've got an American friend who was in the Navy, in the reserve, but he was an admiral, two-star admiral. He's qualified for Kona several times in that military division and raced out there. So if you're in the military and you're called Scott, maybe you're getting put into a separate little qualification pool.
Yeah, I've never actually tried for the military division. I've always just done standalone age group.
And so, you know, in the UK, how long have they had an RAF triathlon team?
Well before my time. Some of my colleagues have been doing it since the 80s. Mm-hmm. It's been going a long time. It's changed over the years. I think, you know, the boom of the Olympics and the Brownlees and stuff really helped promote the sport, you know, not just in our country, but in many countries. And I think that's when it really took off especially within the services as well. And we've got quite a healthy club now. We're well over 300 members, but we are spread across the globe. It's not like a normal triathlon club where we meet every Tuesday and go for a swim. We have to, you know, facilitate races. We have race calendars throughout the year that people can meet up and race, you know, with each other, as all being the RAF, but we then race against everyone else as well. And then we have 2 weekend training camps that we try to do every year. So early season, we'll get together for a weekend, and then we do that at the end of season and celebrate all the achievements throughout the year. And last year we did it in October, and we actually made it a Kona party, and we all watched the female Kona race and celebrated that. It was also celebrating all the achievements that we achieved as a club. And then that'll be the same this year in October again for the men's race. But every year we also try and run an overseas training camp, and that's where I am just now in Lanzarote. We're actually on an overseas training camp for the Royal Air Force, where we have 2 individual weeks. Our first week is designed around the higher performance aspect of athletes, where we've got the ones that are chasing performance. And then our second week, which is what we're into now, and we're here till Saturday, we have developing athletes and new to sport. So, you know, we're trying to grow that generation of athletes that are coming into the sport and want to progress, but also offering something for those that are there for not necessarily performance. Yes, everyone wants to do better, but they love the taking part, and we promote the community spirit, and, you know, we have a social aspect to that as well, and it's great.
I hope you're enjoying the show so far and learning a lot. If you aren't already a regular listener, I hope you feel you might come back. please make sure to hit the subscribe button so you know whenever a new episode arrives. I publish these twice a week, ad-free, and with the mission of improving the health and performance of endurance athletes around the world. And to help me, I'd love it if you could share the episode with one person you think could benefit. If you have a couple more minutes, perhaps you could leave me a review on your chosen platform once you've finished listening to this episode. Okay, let's get back to the show. So when you've been in the RAF, do you get the opportunity to join a local club when you're there, or do you just tend to train on your own? Because I guess if you're saying that the RAF tribe's a bit fragmented with everybody being posted in different places, what opportunities are there for training when you're on a particular base?
It depends on what base they're on. We have some that still have a swimming pool and they may do swimming sessions, but that's few and far between now. I think off the top of my head, there's probably four or five across the UK. Mm-hmm. So they have a facility there. But if you're outside of them facilities, most people will still do triathlon training, but they might swim in the local swimming pool. I'm quite fortunate where I am at the minute. The local pool in North Yorkshire is funded by the military, so I can still go and swim. From a club's perspective, some of them do have a club element at different RAF stations. Most people will join a local club. Mm. So again, going back to my early days in doing the sport, I was a member of Salisbury Triathlon Club, and that's where I started off my coaching journey with Salisbury Triathlon Club, and the coaches there sort of welcomed me in and they helped me get onto the ladder of coaching by doing my level one with them. And in fact, I did my level two with Salisbury Triathlon Club, so it's now the foundation and the group coaching courses. And then it was at that point that then I went into the RAF sort of circle and started coaching for them. So my first coaching experience was actually with a civilian club, although I was serving in the RAF at the time.
Okay. Whereabouts are you based now? Are you up at Catterick?
I'm at RAF Leeman, which is just south of Catterick.
I like going swimming at the open air at the lake there, just to the east of Catterick racecourse. Can't think what it's called now, but Ellerton, yeah, Ellerton Park or something, yeah. I used to take, because it's an hour's drive for me, but I'd take my bike up there, particularly in lockdown when you could swim open water, go and swim for an hour, then get on my bike, maybe ride up to Beedale or out to Richmond or just ride down to North Ellerton, nice and flat.
Beedale's where I go swimming.
Yeah, yeah, it's a nice part of the world there for riding, isn't it? There's a bit of everything.
It is. And, you know, again, I'm there as, although I've got married, I've got children, but my family live in Shropshire. So I commute from work to home. And when I'm over at home, then I've got, basically in my local area, there's a load of lakes. They come from the Ice Age. That's where they're formed. And there's a specific lake that I go and swim in, and it's 800 meters straight down the middle. And just go any time of the day, you can turn up and swim, and it's good fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So what year did you start coaching then?
So I started doing all my coaching courses, I believe, in 2014 as well.
Okay. So you were all in, everything, coaching, training, Ironman racing.
Yeah, straight in there. So, I joined Salisbury Tri Club because it was local to where I was working at the time. And they must have seen something there. And they asked me if I wanted to get involved. And I did, again, opportunity, that word opportunity. I just jumped at the chance and thought, enjoying this. Let's have a go. And here I am today.
Here you are. Well, you were on a high-performing coach program, one of the British Triathlon's highest level that I was part of leading a few months back. But I know that you've been coached now. That's sort of 2022, 23, so that's 9 years into your coaching. You've got your own coaching business. So tell us a little about your own coaching business. And then because you're also, you mentioned you're on that RAF Tri camp now, you're head coach at RAF Tri, so we're sort of getting a sense of those hats that I talked about a bit earlier on.
Yeah, it's certainly I'm not one to hold back, and I'll take things as they come, and if I'm enjoying it, and I'll run with it and do everything else if I can. The very first start, you know where I started there coaching, but over the years I've coached during COVID, actually Whitchurch Triathlon Club. They were struggling. during that lockdown period. And we all know how good sport is for mental health, and it's really important. And they asked me if I could help them out because they didn't have the right qualifications to continue to lead stuff. So I helped them out for a bit as well as a supporting head coach for them. I've been to universities and done pieces with some squads over the years. Just, I've been asked to go along and help other coaches. And then, through the REF system, I've developed, as I've gone through that, coaching new to sport, developing athletes. I've been exposed to high performing athletes, and eventually went into a deputy head coach role. And then a couple of years later, I was asked to become the head coach, which is where I sit today within the REF triathlon committee. Since I've been doing that, we've also developing other coaches. So rather than me doing all the coaches, I've got level ones, level twos and level two diplomas. So your foundation course, your group course, and then obviously the diploma side of it. So the coaches that can do one-to-one as well. And that's something I'm still working on today. And this year we've got some courses for tri-service. So I'm also developing coaches now from a foundation and group course with British Triathlon for all three services of the UK. And that's happening in May and September this year, which is really exciting. Yeah. And then, my own little bit of coaching on the side, which I do on a one-to-one basis as well, and Tri-Wolf Coaching, which I use Instagram as the main platform. But that's going really well. It's grown. It's exciting. I'm loving it. So I get the best of both worlds. I get my work, which I absolutely love. I get to do the sport, which I love as well. And then I get to do all this coaching as well, which is fantastic. So many hats, but I put myself in a position and I love it. I love life.
I'm just going to take a breather now and get my bearings on all of this. So in those club coaching experiences, have you had the opportunity to be a head coach of a club?
So with RAF Triathlon,
what I wanted to do actually was compare running a club like Salisbury or Whitchurch that you talked about, where it's a club coach and you've got a nucleus of people locally versus the more disparate nature of being head coach at RAF Tri.
So with Whitchurch, it was a temporary fixture for me. I kind of sat in and helped them do and continue to deliver what they need to do. And I was just making sure they're on the right path and everything was facilitated and they can do things under the British Triathlon umbrella as it should be done. And that was kind of where probably my first exposure to that really was. Although at the time I was deputy head coach to Royal Air Force Triathlon, so I was kind of covering both positions at the same time there. And they definitely hold value and weight in each. I learn from every experience, and I've had to transfer things I've learned from both in both aspects as well, which is I think it's helped me develop as well.
So how has it been? Obviously that's quite a prestigious position as well, and a lot of honor comes with that, being people have recognized your coaching skills and experience and head of one of the key services in the country. But you've got people as a member of that all over the place. So you're not necessarily running what we'd call traditional training sessions. How do you keep tabs on what folks are doing then when you're doing that?
So we allow all the coaches to continue to do things with CPD. So I basically have a database of the coaches I currently have working with me, and I just make sure that they're up to date with all their licenses, their competencies, whether that's safeguarding, if they want to develop as a coach and go and do open water skills or strength and conditioning, then we try and facilitate that with British Triathlon as well. And we encourage them to go and develop as a coach and work with the civilian clubs, or if they're on a station that has all the facilities, to work with them as well, because we know that as a coach, and where you're going to develop is by delivering this stuff. And because as an association, we only get together for, the overseas training camps, which we're on now, and then the two other periods throughout the year. There's a lot of space within that calendar where potentially they might not coach. So we try and encourage them to work with other people and develop with local clubs.
Okay. So getting a sense, it's more managing other coaches and actually coaching athletes directly that are within the RAF. Is that right?
Yeah. So the only time we coach athletes directly is when they're with us, effectively. Okay. We do have the inter-service triathlons at various distances where we race against the other services. And a new thing for this year, what we've got is we've got pre-training for them events. So And a prime example of that is later on this year, we're running 3 days where we're going to go away and train as a squad. And then that will be in preparation for a said event. So that's another sort of fixture that's developing as well. So yeah, it's a little bit different to your normal clubs out there.
Yeah, yeah. So you wouldn't, each base wouldn't necessarily have its own designated triathlon coach trying to put sessions on then for those who are interested.
Some do, but yeah, not all of them. And then because we have a high turnover of job roles and locations and stuff as well, you know, when people move away, some things can sort of fizzle out a little bit. So yeah, it's constantly evolving and changing. But I definitely think as an association, we're in a far better place than we were 10 years ago. From a coaching perspective and athletes as well, we're booming really.
Mm. Yeah, I guess there's not much call for triathlon coaching in Falklands, right?
No, but there is. We have athletes out there as we speak that are getting some training as well. But the weather's changing. The weather's changing out there.
And I guess those athletes would be training knowing that they're coming back to Europe and just wanted to maintain the fitness somehow while they're out there, wouldn't they?
Yeah, but they do have a swimming pool.
Do they really? With the penguins?
Yeah, but they're just coming out of their summer period now, so it's starting to get colder.
Yeah, I would imagine that summer in the Falklands just never gets that warm, does it?
I think it does. I think I've never been out there personally, but I think it gets substantially warmer than what it does do in the winter. So yeah, they get outside still and train.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so right now let's get onto these hats, right? So you've got Scott Hill. You're married with children.
Yeah, two kids.
So Scott Hill, the husband, Scott Hill, the parent. And you've obviously mum and dad, so family. So Scott Hill, the family man. You've got Scott Hill, the RAF head coach. Scott Hill, the Tri-Wolf coach. Scott Hill, the triathlete. We'll come on to Race Skin Ambassador, but that's something you do. And the reason that does take a bit of your time, because we often meet up at races, don't we, where you're helping Colin out on one of his race skin stands at the outdoor events. So you're Scott Hill, the ambassador. And Scott Hill, the human being who needs to eat, sleep, and do all the normal stuff that human bodies do. So that's eight different hats I've counted there. Have I missed any?
Don't think so. Maybe my primary job, which fits in as well.
Forgot that. Yeah. So nine hats. So,
yeah.
And I know that when you were doing the high performing coach program with us, you were acting up for your former boss who'd left. And while they were waiting to fill that vacancy, you were doing that job. And it was a busy time for the military because you had the Queen passing away and then all of the military preparations around the coronation and all of that stuff that I know you were involved with. So how do you make sure you get enough sleep? How do you make sure you get enough training to do the events you want? And how do you make sure that you still fulfill all those other obligations that you've got?
So I've got a very understanding wife. That's probably the biggest one. I've been very lucky when it comes to my relationship with my wife and my kids. You know, they understand what I do. And they, you know, they live in Shropshire and I don't live in Shropshire. I work in Yorkshire. So I have to commute between the two as well. So it's time management is a big thing. My high performing coaching course was delayed a year for me. I was meant to be on it a year prior, but unfortunately I got called away to go and drive ambulances in West Wales because of the crisis through COVID and stuff. So I was supporting, you know, that aspect. So it got delayed, but I've always been renowned and known for my memory. I've got a very good memory. You know, I come from not the best education through school, you know, suffering with dyslexia and stuff like that. But I think my strength throughout all of that is actually my memory. And it's not necessarily memory for reading and writing, but I've got a memory where I remember certain aspects of what things might happen in life or what's coming up or what has happened. And I managed to program things that way relatively well, I think. And I don't necessarily need to jot things down in diaries or have notebooks or things. It's kind of ingrained in my mind. And I've learned to sort of hone in on that skill through my military career. And it's paid dividends in the long term because obviously I do have all these different aspects to my life and I do manage to do them somehow. And a lot of people think I'm too busy, but I manage it. It is busy. I don't think it's stressful. I don't tend to get stressed out. I'm not afraid to say no to people. And I think that's a key aspect to that. You know, I do have a limit, and I can and will say no if I need to. Or I just program things for another period, and prioritize things, make sure that I'm doing the most important things first, and then prioritize things down to the latter end of the list. And I do that in triathlon. I do that in my training, in my racing. I do that in my day job and just general life. And it's worked okay.
I mean, that's what I'm curious about is that period where you were studying for the HPC, because quite a lot of, it's quite intense, that course. There's a lot of, it's not technical, but there's a lot of reflecting, a lot of thought goes into it, and perhaps more than most folks might expect. If you've already got races in the calendar, but then you have to take on the role, two roles at work, you can't really say no to those jobs. You know, they sort of need to be done. Somebody's got to do them, and you're next one in line. So that's difficult. It's difficult to abdicate being a parent or being a husband. So if you've got races that you want to prepare for and training that needs to be done, how do you manage your training load? Because I'm not trying to put you on the spot here. I'm interested because I think other folks are interested, because these things happen to other people and they have to, you know, you and I probably get questions from people all the time saying, how am I going to manage my training load? Because now I've got this. When you talk about prioritizing, you're training for an Ironman, you've got 15 hours of training a week, and all of a sudden your time's cut down a bit. What decisions are you making around training and rest there to make sure you get done what needs to be done and still stay healthy?
So I have a cut off at the evening. So, you know, if I'm coaching people, I tend to do most of that in the evening. So I don't do that during day hours. That's at nighttime when I wouldn't say relaxing, but it's time that I've got to do that. But I always have a cutoff. So, you know, like 9 o'clock, that's my limit. It gives me an hour to sort of deload. And then 10 o'clock, I'm normally in bed, and I'm probably in bed till 6 o'clock the next day. And that's what I try to get on a daily sort of sleep pattern. Training wise, I try to swim most mornings before work. So I'll get up, I'll go for a swim, and then I'll have breakfast at work normally. So I'll swim and then eat my breakfast at work. So it's just factoring little things in like that. And with people I coach, it is one of the biggest questions I get is, you know, I've got this and I've got that to do and this. And I try to get people to plan their week and structure things. You know, if it's as simple as taking your swim kit to work, for example, and mm-hmm. driving home and going swimming rather than going home first, you know, you've got more chance of achieving that than you have by going home and then sitting on the sofa with a cup of sure. tea with the family. It's then harder to get yourself back out the door. So it's doing things like that, you know, prepping your cycle kit. You know, if you're on the turbo, prep mm-hmm. it the night before. So if you get up early in the morning, it's there, good to go. And it just takes 30 seconds to set it up. And in the morning, it's there. You can get on it, get it done. And I think if you can hit a training session in the morning before work, it makes you feel better. You feel like you're not chasing time in the day. You've got a sense of achievement because you've ticked that one off. And most people, if they do a bit of exercise every day, are more productive in mm. things like work and the rest of life. Mm. Those that get absorbed into the world around them and sucked into doing all this work, I think end up stressed because they're then chasing other things. You know, I need to fit this and I need to fit that in. But if you can tick one off early in the morning, if you can, then I think it's just a big bonus and it sets you up perfectly for the day. So that's how I start my days, is by trying to get a session in as early as I can. And then if I need to do a second session, at some point it might fall in. It could be a lunchtime break. You know, fortunately, being on a military establishment, we all have our gyms. We've got showers there as well. But if it's at the end of the day, I'll try and do it before an evening meal so that I have got the rest of the evening to spend time with the family if I'm with them, or do any other extra work I need to do.
Do you find that with experience and obviously coaching knowledge that you have a confidence that if you can't manage the full cycling or running program you set yourself, there's a basic minimum that you need to do that will at least keep you where you're at until such time as you have an opportunity to get in a long ride or a bit more running volume?
So we've got to accept that life gets in the way. And at the end of the day, our jobs for most of us is what puts food on the table for us and our families. And that's first and foremost the important thing in life. You know, we're not pro triathletes, most of us, and we have to ensure that we can pay to do the sport. We can support our family as well. And it's work that does that. But at the same time, I try to encourage people to take time for themselves and do exercise because it will help them as well. Deload, de-stress, and just set you up for the day. It can be a balancing act. I think, you know, if things get in the way and people are struggling to fit something in, you know, if, let's say, for example, right, tomorrow you've got a 2-hour ride planned, but you know you're not going to be able to achieve that, then let's look at what else is planned for the week and can we shift things around mm-hmm. to still achieve, you know, it might be Saturday, right? There's a 30-minute session. Okay, can we switch this around and still achieve something? And that way it's a win for the athlete. You know, they're still on course for their program. Yes, in an ideal world, we want everything to be smooth sailing and, you know, the road is never smooth. It's not like that. It's not like life. And we have to move things around. But also as athletes and coaches, we need to understand that athletes are going to miss stuff. People with people, we miss stuff. And sometimes you've got to accept that, you know, that training peaks is just going to go red. That's fine.
Yeah, it's not a particular game changer, is it? If it goes red, it's just red.
No, but people chase the training piece green, and it's You know, I show my athletes mine sometimes. I'm like, look, you're normal. This is mine. It's fine.
Well, talking about things going red, I know that you were dealing with sort of a bad back for quite a while last year, which derailed your training, and obviously that makes you feel miserable all the time, doesn't it? Bad back, because it's sort of like there, it never goes away. How did you deal with that then? You know, because some people, you talk about road bumps and having to deal with adversity. When some folks get injured, they crumble, and other folks are just like, okay, so it's happened. I can still do this and I can still do that. So that's what I'll do, and let's get it fixed the best way possible.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, so what we know, 2024. So I popped a disc, L4, L5 disc in September 22. At first, we didn't realize what I'd done. My foot went numb during a run and it gradually got worse and worse. And about 12:30 that night, I drove myself to A&E because the pain was too much. And I pretty much got told you had a trapped nerve. You take some ibuprofen and on your way. And you know, that was on a Saturday. On the Monday, the pain was still pretty intense. At the time, I was at the camp that I work on, and I went, well, I actually phoned the medical center and said, I'm in quite a lot of pain. This happened on Saturday. I went to hospital, and they asked me if I could then go to see them. And I, at that point, I couldn't get out of my bed. I was literally stuck in my room for 2 weeks. So I got some stronger medication that got delivered to me at the time. That started to ease off, you know, a little bit of movement. I was trying to move as much as I could. I mean, I got a turbo trainer set up in my room. I was trying to get active because it's oxygenated blood that repairs the body normally, isn't it? So I'm aware of this, and I'm aware that I'm a firm believer that we have to stay mobile to stay active, to stay moving, to help recovery, and to obviously help the mind and everything else as well. And yeah, I was in that room for 2 weeks. It was hard mentally, but I tried to stay focused. I then thought, right, I need to switch focus here. It's not, you know, it's now, I was meant to go to Mexico that year actually to do the Ironman. So straight away emailed them, not going to make it. Can I defer a year? Which they agreed to. And the recovery process became a focus. And I didn't find out until the January that I'd actually popped the disc. I'd gone through the medical process, spoke to physios, and it was all, yeah, you've got a trapped nerve, you need to stretch more type chat. And it got to the point when I'd actually turned around and said, I need to have this MRI'd. I'm happy to pay for it myself. And I got an MRI scan in the end, and yeah, pop disc. But I think my pain threshold was quite high. I got moving again. I was still in a lot of pain. I still suffer today. It's not perfect, but I'm fully mobile. I'm active, and I'm a firm believer that it was me pushing to stay active and be active that allowed me to bounce back. I couldn't do certain things, but I think we've got to switch focus. We've got to, you know, if we can't run, but we can do other things, let's work with a rehab specialist. Let's work with physios, doctors, you know, and if you can cycle a bike, or you can still swim, or you can do your rehab stuff, then make that the priority, really, really hone in on that as the focus, and you'll come back better than you think and faster than you think.
Yeah. Nobody has a smooth path anywhere, do they? Really? We've all got obstacles and, hiccups and things that get in the way, and it's the folks that I've found that do the best in the long term are those ones who are able to deal with those road bumps pragmatically and then find a solution, even if it's not the perfect one.
Yeah, we've got many people out there, you know, some of them will just fold and, you know, they can't cope and they'll just stop everything. And I think that's a really bad thing to do. We've just got to switch focus a little bit, stay active and bounce back. Every triathlete, every athlete out there at some point has had an injury. Many of them still suffer with aches and pains, but we're still trying to achieve the events and participate and triathlon training with clubs and stuff, but we just adapt, and the human body is really good for that.
Yeah, I mean, I hear people saying, well, you can expect to get injured if you're doing triathlon, and I'm not sure that it's a given, that it's an inevitable that you'll get injured if you're doing the right things. However, when you ride your bike more out on the road, when you're running through mud, you know, there's probably an increased risk of something happening. And most people that you and I know, including ourselves, probably like to just see how far we can push that envelope, don't we? And you know, for a fact that sometimes you're going to go a bit too far.
Yeah, but I think if we listen to the body as well, and you know, if something starts to come on, you know, you've got a little nigger of pain, but we've got to be smart as well and think, you know what, if I push through this, it could get worse. Let's back off. Let's accept training peaks is going to go red or orange or whatever color it's going to go. Let's speak to the coach, let's speak to a medical profession, and just ensure that it's not going to go into a long-term recovery and it's just a short-term thing.
There's a couple of things you mentioned there. Training peaks isn't the only culprit, of course. I think social media and certainly the apps now that sort of have these challenges, you know, say how many miles, can you get 500 Strava miles in January? Can you do these challenges? You know, new king of the mountains, they're encouraging you to get involved and to do stuff, which is probably a good thing if it's getting people off the couch. But I do feel like sometimes folks are overly focused on what those apps are telling them versus what their body's telling them.
Yeah, and that pays dividends. I mean, we had athletes here last week that literally just wanted to destroy themselves all week, and we had to, you know, try to educate them. You don't need to do all of this extra training, you know, it's not going to make you fitter in a week. Yes, we're here, we're training a little bit more than you probably would do in the UK, but ultimately it's more than the training. It's about socializing with like-minded athletes. It's about building that rapport with each other, that team ethos. It just holds so much more value. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Some people will just take these challenges and run with them, and then wonder why they pick up an injury or an illness, because, you know, their immune system's been shot. It's very common.
One hat I forgot to mention, the race skin ambassador role. Tell us about that, because you've been involved with Colin now for a while, haven't you?
Yeah. So, yeah, I've known Colin for some time now. I tend to help him out quite a lot at the outlaw events. So that's, you know, our paths cross quite a lot there. I've been involved in racing outlaw events since pretty much the start. I think the first one I ever did for them was Holcomb. And yeah, I mean, Colin's kit, you know, his tri-suits, he makes the ones for the RAF. So he makes the Royal Air Force's tri-suits, but he also makes my one for my tri-wolf coaching as well, which, you know, if people see the bright green out there on course, it's my own sort of coaching business and the athletes that I coach there. So I love the kit that he produces there, you know, the designs, the quality of what it is and the different options. And, you know, I've got hoodies and tri-suits from Colin now as well, and some cycle kit and things like that as well. But it's allowed me to be part of the sport a bit more, if that makes sense. So now when I go and help Colin on these stalls at these events, I'm now engaging with athletes from a different angle.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I've got my day job, but it also gives me something else to do. You know, and I do this purely on a voluntary basis as well with Colin. And we've built a good friendship over the years. And yeah, it's just given me a different angle to the sport.
I think that, you know, I've known Colin since before he set up Raceskin, and for me, it's a great company. The product's great. It's got a leader of that company who's passionate, but he also, you know, he does sponsor some elite athletes, but he sponsors a lot of age group athletes and folks like you who are well known within the sport for their age group exploits. You know, and they use the product because not because somebody's going to give them a boatload of cash, because that's not going to happen, but because it's a good product. And you probably, like me, you appreciate the philosophy and the ethics that they have as a company as well, and the way they go about the business, which is why you are willing to hang around, you know, the day before a race and chat to people on an expo stand.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's also a British brand, and being British military, I've got that connection there as well. And yeah, Racekin are very supportive, and I'm very grateful for everything they've done for me over the years. It's been good, and I'm sure it'll be for many more years, hopefully. But I'll see Colin again at some more of the outdoor events this year, so no doubt we'll bump into each other as well.
Well, I'll be there. Are you planning on being at all of them, or just the halves?
Not 100% confirmed at the minute. I'm hoping to be at Holcomb. I hopefully will be at the full, but I won't be participating in anything. If I do something, I might just go and do the long swim, because I'd quite like to do that one as well. Mm-hmm. But the 70.3 early in the year, yet to be decided. I've just got some things I need to check with work when I get back from Lanzarote next week.
Okay, and back to your own racing ambitions then. I hesitate to say you're getting on a bit now, because you're not at 41 really, but you've been around in the sport for a while, and you've obviously raced in Kona twice. Are you still as competitive with other people as you might have been at the start, or are you more competitive with your own sort of, what can I achieve and how long can I keep going at this level?
I don't think I've really ever been competitive against other people. And I think that's a different angle. Most people chase performance. You know, and I'm not afraid to say that, you know, I've joined the sport later in life. I'm never going to bridge the gap with professional triathletes. That's never going to happen. I'm fully immersed in the sport. I love the sport. And yes, I would like to perform better as the years goes on, but I don't pitch up to a race, and I don't look at the race starting list, looking at all these athletes thinking, oh, I'm not as fast as them, or I can beat them. I just, you don't know what happens on the day. So, I start the race. I do what I do. I race to numbers, whether that's pace on the run or power on the bike and the swim. And I just do it because I love it, and I love participating in it. And yes, I've had some good results where I've had podiums. But that, for me, that's not what it's about. You know, I like to participate. I like to do the races. And at the minute, I'm enjoying traveling the world, doing some other races in other countries. I went to Mexico in November. Obviously, I mentioned earlier, I had to defer a race because of my back. And that was a deferral to do Cozumel. But at the same time, they had a 70.3 on 2 weeks prior. And I thought, well, while I'm there, let's go and do the 70.3. So I did that exactly 2 weeks before. And for me at the time, it worked really well in my prep to go and do the full 2 weeks later. And I didn't perform the best on the race. I mean, the swim was cancelled. But the run, I felt so good on that run, just comfortable. And I loved it. And I think that 70.3 2 weeks before really helped. And I got to experience two parts of Mexico, very different. And yeah, it's allowed me to travel the world. And that's what I'm looking forward to this year as well, with a couple of other events in the UK and abroad.
So you're doing, you said you're doing Fishguard. That's a new race this year, right? For 70.3. Is it a challenge, that one?
That's challenge. Yeah. So that's in Fishguard, South Wales. I've never done that one before. And that's just, again, just to go and experience and do something different. I've actually never done a challenge event, so that's been my first one. And then the plan then is to go and race in Estonia to do Ironman Tallinn. And then, Spain to do Ironman Barcelona in October.
I mean, that's the one thing that I feel like I've always wanted to do with triathlon, was what I call triathlon tourism. You know, it's given me, I don't think I'd ever have gone to Klagenfurt or Penticton if it hadn't been for the triathlon there. And yet, those are two of the most amazing places that I've been to that, you know, if you like swimming and you like being out in the hills and in the open countryside, those are two beautiful places of the world. And I've met some great people as well. So it's that community, and it's the triathlon experiences, the travel experiences, that I feel like are probably more important to me than the time I do. It's the time I have that will remain with me.
Yeah, absolutely. And this year in Estonia, I've got eight of us going, eight of the athletes I coach, we're going out there. And that's just as much about participating in the sport with them that I've built really good friendships with, and we're all going to stay together. You know, we'll socialize for the week in the build up. We'll see the sights. We'll do a little bit of training, and then obviously we'll all be on the race course together as well. And that's something we'll get to share for the rest of our days.
Yeah, brilliant, Scott. It's been great to chat with you. I'm looking forward to seeing you at the Outlaw. I always like to go to Holcombe because I don't think I've ever been there when it's rained. So it's like that part of Norfolk's a nice place to be. So I'm looking forward to seeing you there, maybe at the full after that as well. So enjoy the rest of your trip to Lanzarote and keep up the good work and keep control of all those hats.
No, thanks very much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Scott. Take care. See you out there. Thank you again to Scott for being my guest on the show this week. If you're planning to be at any of those outlaw events, then you'll be able to catch Scott at some of them this year. So please do stop by the Racing booth and say hello if you've got the time. And when you finish listening, please make sure you check out the show notes for links to all of those items that we mentioned in the conversation. At that time, perhaps you could take a moment to share the episode with just one person you think could benefit. If you can, that'll be awesome. And if you've got a little bit more time, perhaps you could leave me a review on your chosen platform once you've finished listening to this episode. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll have another great guest in 7 days' time, and I hope that you'll be able to join me.